morale was too crucial. An officer took over. An hour and a half had passed since the fire started, and the men huddled in the forward torpedo room began to pass out from the gases. It was clear that everyone there was going to have to come back out on the perilous deck. As many as possible would crowd onto the bridge. One after another, men were hauled up through the conning tower as the captain watched, thinking that some of them looked more dead than alive. One man was dragged out unconscious and not breathing. His mates began blowing air into his lungs, pumping his chest. Back aft, Wright was in agony. Eason pumped him full of morphine, then tried to treat the other man's burns with petroleum from his first aid kit. Meanwhile, Captain Worthington was trying to find a way to send Tusk's medic over to Cochino, perhaps on a rubber raft. His men began pumping diesel fuel overboard, more than 16,000 gallons, working to create a deliberate oil slick in an effort to calm the waves. Tusk shot a line over to Cochino. Men on both subs would try to hold onto the rope to create a lifeline through the water that could pull the raft forward. The first time out, Tusk's men lost hold, but on the next try, a new line held. Watching the waves, Worthington realized that it was still too dangerous to send a man over. Instead, Tusk sent the raft unmanned, filled with medical supplies, including drugs and whiskey. Benitez also knew the dangers, knew that anyone trying to cross the rough seas on that raft could easily be lost. But by 2 p.m., as he counted the continuing explosions under his feet, he had come to realize that he had no choice. He needed to tell the officers on Tusk just how dire his situation was, that Cochino's men might have to abandon ship. He needed to send more information than Austin could by fighting the wind to flag messages one letter at a time. Above all, he needed to see whether it was possible to use the raft to transfer his crew to the safety of Tusk. The captain asked Shelton whether he would be willing to try to make the dangerous transit across. He was, and another man wanted to go with him. It was Robert Philo, the young civilian sonar expert who had come along for the exercises that would now never happen. "Philo, is this something that you want to do?" Benitez said, slowly, deliberately. "Yes?" Benitez repeated the question, word for word, just as deliberately, with perhaps a bit more emphasis on the word "want." Again, Philo answered, "Yes?" Benitez took a breath. "Fine. You and Shelton go." Even as he said it, he thought that he'd have a hell of a time explaining how a civilian got onto that raft if something went wrong. But there were men burned, men gassed, men freezing. The captain had no time to fight, no time to try to yell above the wind to find out whether Philo was trying to be a hero or trying to abandon ship. No time to warn that as bad as things were on Cochino, that trip on the raft could very well be worse. All he could do was ask Philo whether he was sure, then ask once again. As soon as Cochino's crew lowered the raft with Philo and Shelton into the water, it overturned. Now the two men were clutching straps that looped across the raft's bottom as they were dragged through the pounding waves by men aboard Tusk. Benitez watched helplessly as Shelton began to drift away while trying to swim back to the raft. Then Benitez couldn't watch any further. He had to turn his attention back to his sub. Tusk's men were in a far better position to attempt a rescue. Besides, Cochino had no steering. Her maneuvering stations were cut off by toxic gas. It was all Benitez could do to try to keep his other men safe. There were now 57 men crammed with him into Cochino's sail and bridge. Below decks and aft were 18 more men, 5 of them burned, including Wright. The gassed men topside were still in bad shape. The crew's quarters and their foul weather gear were cut off by gas. Everyone was freezing, especially Morgan, who was still shivering from his earlier immersion. Benitez took off his jacket and gave it to one man. Then he took off his shoes and gave them to another. Now Benitez stood in shirt sleeves and stocking feet, wanting more than anything to get some of his men off the boat, over to Tusk. If he could manage to keep a skeleton crew on board, he was certain he could get Cochino home, even if she had to be towed in and beached. He was still determined not to abandon ship, not when Wright couldn't be moved. Benitez was not going to leave the sub without his exec. But Tusk was again out of sight. Benitez hadn't seen the end of Shelton and Philo's attempt to reach her, and didn't know that Philo had been thrown by the waves hard against Tusk, leaving him limp, face down in the water. By the time a Tusk crewman jumped in and grabbed hold of him, Philo was bleeding and no longer breathing. Tusk officers began working on him right on deck, performing mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and administering adrenaline. Shelton was pulled aboard 3 minutes later, conscious but suffering from exposure. He was taken below, where, shivering violently, he managed to give Benson and Worthington their first detailed report about the catastrophe unfolding on the other sub, about the arcing batteries, the explosions, the toxic cloud that had consumed most of Cochino's interior. Outside, on Tusk's deck, were 15 crewmen, some administering to Philo, who had no evident pulse, others trying to keep the rescue party from being swept overboard. Suddenly, a huge wave hit Tusk, then another so powerful it bent four pipe stanchions that had been securing a lifeline for the men outside. All at once, 12 men were washed overboard, Philo among them. Worthington and his crew scanned the seas. Philo and another man were out of sight altogether. One man was spotted face down in the water. Worthington began again fighting the currents, trying to reach his men. But the horror was becoming worse. Unlike anyone on Cochino, two of Tusk's men had time to put on foul weather gear, and now that gear was conspiring to drown them. The gear was another Navy experiment, one-piece suits, prototypes designed to protect the crew from the Arctic cold. They were built with May Wests, inflatable life preservers sewn directly into the jackets and boots that clamped tightly onto the suits, with metal ankle grooves that required a special tool to unlock them. The suits had seemed fine on deck, but on one worn by Chief John G. Guttermouth, the attached life jacket burst when it hit the frigid water. That left only one part of the suit highly buoyant, the boots, which were sealed so tight that they retained air pockets. Guttermouth was desperately trying to swim toward a lifeline, towing an unconscious mate. The two men were only 20 yards away, close enough to be saved. Guttermouth's feet were coming up toward the surface, forcing his head down. Worthington watched, horrified, as the chief fought his boots for his life, watched as Guttermouth let go of the other man, who sank instantly. Guttermouth's boots then brought his feet to the surface. Worthington would write in Tusk's log. He attempted to right himself by swimming, but was unable to do so, and drowned, with his feet still above the surface of the water. There was no time to mourn. There were other men in the water. The rescue continued. More men jumped overboard to help. Other men, already in the water, tried to grab hold of mates in worse shape than they were. Lieutenant Junior Grade L. Philip Pennington was in the water 1 hour and 25 minutes before he was pulled onto the sub. Raymond T. Reardon was spotted in a life raft, but was tossed out by the waves. Another man jumped in and grabbed him. By now, it was 2 hours since the men had gone overboard. Worthington was faced with a nearly unbearable reality. 7 men were still in the water, and they were almost certainly dead. Nobody on Cochino knew that the disaster had logged its first death, but death was on everyone's mind. Austin was thinking about his wife and two kids, about sinking below the waves before he could see them again. He was comforted by the thought that he had always heard that the frigid water would knock a man out before the very end. Benitez continued to assess and reassess their situation. He had made three attempts to vent his boat, but gas continued leaching through. He tried to send some men aft over the deck, past the damaged battery compartment, to the very end of the boat, where Eason was still ministering to Wright, the one corner of the sub that was still gas-free. But the first two men to try were nearly washed overboard. Two attempts were made to crack the conning tower hatch, but each time gas came rushing out, inviting disaster. The picture of the men gassed early that afternoon was still vivid in Benitez's mind. He couldn't risk exposing all the men crammed into the sail to the same fate. There wasn't much to do now but wait and pray a little. 6 hours had passed since the first explosion. The fires still raged when Tusk once again broke through the fog. It would be hours more before Benitez would learn that the sub was carrying 7 fewer men than before. All that was on his mind now was getting Cochino home. Cochino's steering was a loss. Still, Benitez had hopes of driving his sub to calmer seas, where he could safely get the wounded over to Tusk, which could then race ahead and get the men to Hammerfest, Norway, and to a hospital. Benitez tried to follow Tusk for nearly an hour, but Cochino kept turning in circles. Then one of the wounded, below at the very rear of the sub, managed to restore steering by holding his pain-racked body against a pipe wrench he had crammed into a rudder control valve. He steered by blindly following Benitez's piped-in instructions. Finally, Cochino could follow Tusk. It was about 7:10 p.m., nearly 9 hours since the first explosion. Over the sub's internal phones, Benitez kept assuring the wounded that they were nearing Norway. "Only 3 hours away," he had said at one point that afternoon. Then, 4 hours later, he repeated his promise. "Only 3 more hours." Even then, he knew it would be at least twice that long before they would near land. "We had to slow down so that the men forward would not suffer from the seas still breaking over the bridge," Benitez said, trying to sound as reassuring as he could. "I know that you will understand." The men back aft knew he was lying, but they answered, "Of course we understand. Thank you." Benitez choked up, amazed that this group of burned and wounded could still find concern for the men freezing out on deck, could use that concern to ease their own suffering. He wanted to get them home, all of them. It looked as though most of the wounded would make it. Save for Wright, they were showing signs of improvement. The seas were even beginning to abate a bit. Benitez kept talking to his men, encouraging them, asking them to just hang on. The CO was calling upon every moment he had spent in the war, when he had crouched silently among another crew as their sub was depth-charged. If he was showing his aristocracy now, it was the aristocracy of sheer valor, and he was impressing even the hulking, red-headed Celt who stood at his side. Benitez still believed he could win his battle against sub and sea, when another explosion hit shortly after midnight on Friday, August 26th. The boat shook violently, and the fire spread into the second engine room, moving closer to the torpedo room where Wright and the others were. There was no longer any choice. Those men had to come topside. One by one, 15 men climbed out the back hatch and made their way forward. Still, Wright and one of the other injured men could not be moved, and Doc Eason wasn't going to leave them. He told Benitez they could hold out. Meanwhile, the captain knew he had to try to transfer the rest of the crew over to Tusk. In the nighttime haze, Austin did not want to take a chance that Tusk's men would no longer see the signal flags. So he picked up a battle lantern, and using its toggle switch, spelled out in Morse code, "Another explosion. Close me." That done, Benitez turned his attention back to getting those last three men topside. The sound-powered phones had finally gone out. There was no way to communicate. A volunteer offered to run back to the hatch. The seas were still washing over the deck, but there was a better chance now that the man could make it. Benitez gave the okay. He wanted those men topside. Still, from everything he'd been told about Wright's condition, he had little hope the exec would make it out of the sub. Benitez made a silent declaration. "Okay. If he doesn't come out, I'm going to go down into the after torpedo room and go down with him." The sense of clarity was almost overwhelming. A deep calm washed over him. It was the same feeling he'd had during the war when he was on the submarine Dace, as it was being pummeled by Japanese destroyers, when he had believed there could be no escape. He had been lucky that time. Now he thought, "Well, I'm going to die. This is it." He fretted for a moment that he'd be swept off the deck on his way aft, or worse, be swept off and rescued, leaving Wright to die alone. But he shook away the thought. His calm gave way to a sense of peace, a peace that seemed to pass all understanding, reaching beyond feeling to prayer. Meanwhile, Tusk prepared to move closer. First, her crew fired off the warshot torpedoes loaded in her bow tubes, ensuring that there would be no explosions if the two subs crashed, or if Tusk was too close when there was another violent explosion on Cochino. Then Tusk maneuvered alongside. Back on Cochino, members of the crew prepared to go aft and carry Wright out, but as they looked back, they saw him follow another man climbing out of the after torpedo room. He had somehow managed to claw his way off the bunk, stagger to the ladder below the hatch, and force himself to lift 1 foot high enough to reach the first rung. The pain was excruciating. He had to stop, and as he stood there, he was aware of Doc Eason behind him, aware of the water sloshing across the compartment floor. The sub was flooding now. Later, Wright would swear that he had no idea how he began climbing again, would swear that it felt almost as if an invisible hand, maybe it was Eason's, had grabbed him by the seat of his pants and pushed him up the ladder and onto the deck. As Benitez watched, he noticed Wright's hands in front of him, heavily bandaged. Other crewmen were watching, too, as Wright started moving forward. There were no cheers, no shouts. Some of the men ran to help, but there was almost no place to grab onto Wright without causing him more agony. In silence, they watched him take one labored step after another. Men on both subs were already working to secure a narrow plank between them. Nobody was left below now. Everyone was on deck. Most were near the plank, a 20-foot-long swaying teeter-totter that reached from the side of one sub to the side of the other, with barely an inch to spare on either end. Some men grabbed lines, holding the plank in place. But as the ships rolled in the violent surf, the plank would drop from its perch and have to be hoisted back in place. If that plank dropped while a man was making his way over, it was clear that he'd be smashed between steel hulls that were crashing together where the subs were widest, just beneath the waterline. It was one of the least inviting escape routes ever designed at sea. Wright was the first man to walk toward the plank, the men parting before him in stunned silence. One measured, agonized step at a time, he reached the makeshift bridge, and then kept going, across the plank, across to Tusk. That was it. That was all the rest of the crew needed. If Wright could make it in his condition, they could too. One by one, they skittered across, the wounded first. They timed it, waiting as one boat was picked up by the waves, then the other, waiting for that short moment when the boats were level. Nobody cued them. They didn't need masterminding from the bridge now. Each man picked his own moment to rush across. No more than two or three men would get over before the plank would drop and again need to be pulled in place. Miraculously, no one had fallen. When about one-third of the crew had made it to the tusk, the waves pulled the subs apart so far that several of the lines between them parted. Tusk made her way back, but it was clear the remaining lines would not last long. It seemed that the rest of the men made their way across the narrow plank in a matter of seconds, all except Benitez, who still stood on Cochino's deck. Benson called across to Benitez.
"Are you abandoning ship?"
"Hell no!"
Benitez yelled back.
"I'm not abandoning ship!"
He wanted Tusk to stand by and take him in tow. He believed he could still save his boat. It was about 1:45 a.m. on Friday. Cochino was listing to starboard. The rear torpedo room hatch was underwater, and the sub began to take an up angle, leaning back toward the sea. As the angle became more pronounced, Benitez watched tensely, waiting to see whether the sub would stabilize again. A few more degrees, and she would be lost.
"Now!"
men shouted to him from Tusk's deck.
"Now!"
they called out again. They saw it before he did, saw that he had no choice. Benitez stood there as Cochino's stern slipped down, as the sea encroached further and further onto the deck.
"Well, this is it," he said to himself.
Then he called over to Benson, called out the worst words any captain had to speak.
"Abandoning ship."
He made it across the plank, bare seconds before the wood shattered. Worthington was already calling out the orders that would take Tusk clear of the sinking ship, as Benitez began urging his men below. Then he went to the bridge to watch Cochino's final dive. His sub was listing about 15 degrees to starboard. Water was now past her sail. She stood almost straight up in the air, as if taking one last look at the sky, before leaning back and slipping gently below the waves. Cochino sank in 950 feet of water, about 100 nautical miles off the coast of Norway. It was 15 hours since the fire began. Benitez watched until she was gone. He didn't say a word. Not then. Not for nearly an hour after. It was only when he began to speak that Benson and Worthington told him that Philo and 6 Tusk crewmen were dead, their bodies lost. 6 hours later, Tusk pulled into Hammerfest. Some of the men were taken to the hospital, the others were given a choice. They could fly home to New London, Connecticut, or they could ride back, the rescued and the rescuers, both crews crowded aboard Tusk. Every man who could travel went home on Tusk. Cochino's loss made headlines in the United States and in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Navy newspaper Red Fleet published an article accusing the United States of undertaking suspicious training near Soviet waters and of sending Cochino near Murmansk to spy. For its part, the U.S. Navy had gone public with the disaster, acknowledging, in effect, that its men and its fragile boats were not yet any match for the treacherous northern seas. Austin's spy gambit had failed. But the Navy had no intention of disclosing that, or even that a spook had been on board at all. When asked to comment on Soviet claims that Cochino had been near Murmansk, officers gave the same answer that the Navy would offer to other such questions for decades to come. No comment. Despite the tragedy and the initial reluctance of some commanders and admirals, there was no question that the Navy would continue to send subs to monitor the development of the Soviet atomic threat. Just 9 days after Kachino was lost, an Air Force reconnaissance plane picked up evidence that the Soviets had detonated a nuclear device. The other side had the bomb. The anticipated threat that had inspired the submarine spy mission in the first place was now real. Chapter 2. Whiskey a Go-Go. The USS Gudgeon, SS-567, pulled into Yokosuka, Japan on Sunday, July 21, 1957. This was the final stop, the place where submarine crews coming from Pearl Harbor and San Diego could make preparations to sneak close to Soviet shores. This is where they would return after their missions, to celebrate, to relax, to prepare to go out again. Yokosuka had become spy sub central in the Pacific. This base at the tip of Tokyo Bay was marked by a mix of espionage and debauchery, tension and release. It had been a Japanese Navy port and was later taken over by the Allies. Here, an enlisted man could get drunker than hell, and here, officers had created a submarine sanctuary in a walk-up flat decked out with a bar, a few bunks, and images of bare women writhing on black velvet. It had been nearly 8 years since the Kachino tragedy, and submarines had become central to the Cold War intelligence effort. They had proven their worth once and for all during the Korean War, when snorkeling diesel subs were sent into the Sea of Japan to stand watch against any Soviet efforts to intervene. Ever since, even the submarine force's most die-hard warriors had recognized the value of hanging right off the enemy's coast, watching his comings and goings. Unless war broke out, surveillance would be the submariner's primary mission, their reason for being, the best way to gather detail about the Soviet naval buildup that was now unfolding in full force. Spy subs already had brought back news that Soviet shipyards were churning out new long-range subs, including more than 250 Whiskey and Zulu-class boats equipped with snorkels. The Soviet High Command had made clear that it was preparing to challenge the U.S. Navy on the high seas, using the submarine as the principal weapon. The Soviets were still learning how to operate their subs. For example, one of the first 30-day test runs on a Whiskey left her crew so ravaged by noxious gases that their hands and legs were swollen to twice their normal size. Despite these problems, the Soviets continued to move ahead. Indeed, the United States had received reports, albeit unconfirmed, that the Soviet Navy was modifying some of its Zulus to carry missiles, possibly with atomic warheads. That was enough to convince even the most traditional admirals that there was more to this idea of submarine spying than feeding a bunch of egghead analysts stashed away within the bowels of naval intelligence and the still mysterious CIA. Realizing they could use submarines to steal intelligence that was vitally important to the submarine force itself, the admirals leading the Atlantic and Pacific fleets had taken control of this business of submarine spying, running the show, making the assignments. At their orders, subs were lurking underwater, periscopes peeking above the waves, watching through all but the iciest months of the year, as the Soviets put their newest boats through their paces. This was also a great way for submariners to maintain readiness for battle, not just in war games with friendly forces, but by driving up into Soviet waters and facing the adversary. The top priority of any spy sub captain
was what the Navy called indications and warning. Captains were supposed to forget about caution, forget about radio silence, and flash a message home from the Barents or the Sea of Japan if they picked up any sign that the Soviet Navy was mobilizing, perhaps preparing to attack. U.S. spy subs also were now using much more sophisticated versions of Austin's ears to scan for Soviet missile tests. And submarines, antennas at the ready, were routinely picking up the chatter that told the U.S. Navy how many Soviet ships and subs were ready for sea and what their tactics might be in wartime. Increasingly, fleet admirals consulted with naval intelligence, becoming partners in espionage. Intelligence officers invited other Navy men to train alongside them, noting in one invitation that they were engaging in the world's second oldest profession, one with even fewer morals than the first. Most top government officials were given little, if any, indication of the risks the sub-force was taking, or of what a strange game of machismo was being played. While President Dwight D. Eisenhower had only hesitantly approved U-2 spy flights high over Russia, fearful of aggravating Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, many submarine captains believed it was their job, and forget the niceties of international law, to drive straight into Soviet territorial waters. Fleet commanders graded the captains on how long they kept their eyes and ears up out of the water. The more daring the attempt, the higher the grade. This had become a contest of sorts, a test of bravado for the captains, their crews, and their craft. And for most of the captains, these days of unfettered risk would forever mark the high point of their careers. To be sure, there was stress, and lots of it. Some veteran commanders lost 20 pounds running these long Western Pacific deployments, Westpacs in the trade. Nobody could tell ahead of time who would be able to take the pressure and who wouldn't. Gudgeon shoved off from Yokosuka for her turn at the Soviets, with Norman G. Buzz Bazak at the helm. Already he had led Gudgeon, undetected, on a reconnaissance mission beneath a group of Soviet ships operating in icy northern waters. Now he was leading his sub straight into enemy territory, his first command in these dangerous waters. But the 34-year-old lieutenant commander was here in the first place, was on submarines at all, because he craved adventure. In the year and a half since he had taken over Gudgeon, he had convinced his crew that he was one of those go-to-hell-and-back captains, a man who wanted his sub to make her mark among the lumbering propeller planes, the U-2 jets, and the landlocked listening stations that were keeping an eye on the Soviets from all angles. In that, he had a lot in common with the spooks on board his boat. They had their pick of assignments, these men who were the Navy's chief snoops and eavesdroppers. They could have ridden Navy spy planes and been home every night in time for dinner, sleeping with their wives, instead of dozing cheek to toe with a half-dozen men and a torpedo or two. But for the spooks, just about everything about submarines seemed to signal importance and drama. They sneaked aboard with uniforms, like those of Cochino's Austin, altered to bear radio men's sparks instead of their own insignias, the telltale lightning rods and quills. Their written orders said only that they were to report to the USS Classified. It was the spook's job to monitor the enemy, to bring home the intelligence, to give warning if a sub was detected by Soviet ships and coastal installations that were starting to scan the oceans with radar and sonar. Soviet patrol boats had already given chase after several U.S. subs. These were, after all, the years leading up to the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was a time when the Soviet propaganda machine found fodder, even in the fairy tale Hansel and Gretel. churning out a version in which the children of hard-working collective farmers were enslaved by a fat capitalist in a plutocratic residence in the evil West. And Soviet pen pals were writing Americans with offers to exchange pictures of beautiful cathedrals for scenes of North American coastlines, perhaps including ports and harbors. As the men of the Gudgeon prepared to embark, few of them doubted that they were fighters in an undeclared war. Several American spy planes had been shot down, and Gudgeon's crew could only guess what the Soviets would do if they ever cornered an American submarine. Gudgeon was one of the Navy's newest subs, one of the first diesel boats designed from the start with a snorkel and electronic eavesdropping equipment. From its fabled old shipyard in Groton, Connecticut, Electric Boat Company had already finished the Navy's first two nuclear-powered subs, the USS Nautilus, SSN 571, and the USS Seawolf, SSN 575. But Hyman Rickover, now an admiral, wasn't at all sure that he wanted to send his boats directly into the path of the Soviet Navy. He easily wielded enough power to keep them home. Rickover was already a master at power politics. Born in the Jewish Pale of Maków, Poland, about 50 miles north of Warsaw, his family used congressional connections to get him into the Naval Academy. When he first began working on early experiments with nuclear power, he pushed the Navy to begin building nuclear subs by first getting himself appointed to a top staff job at the Atomic Energy Commission. He was so brash that the Navy twice denied him a promotion to Rear Admiral, but Rickover called upon a friend in Congress and got that as well. Now he was employing his nuclear subs as public relations stars. The Navy budget seemed to get another boost every time another congressman got a nuclear-propelled ride. Indeed, Nautilus was preparing for the ultimate in showmanship. The Navy was trying to mark her as the first submarine to slip under the Arctic ice and reach the North Pole. So it was the diesels that were doing all of the spying work, Gudgeon among them, as she steamed north toward Vladivostok, the Soviet's largest naval base in the Pacific. She neared her station for this special operation, or spec op, in early August, carrying three or four spooks, some already hard at work listening for any signs that their approach had been detected. Extra eavesdropping equipment was crammed wherever it could fit. One communications tech, trained in Russian, scanned ship-to-shore transmissions for any Soviet cries of submarine spotted. Another spook began working the electronic countermeasures, listening for radar sweeps that could pick up Gudgeon and signal her need to dive. If he could, he would record a blast of that radar so that U.S. intelligence could look for ways to jam Soviet radar sweeps in the future. A sonar specialist stood ready to help record the sound signatures of any passing Soviet subs and ships. Those unique fingerprints of propeller and machinery noises might later help U.S. forces identify Soviet ships and subs at sea. As always, what the spooks would ultimately collect had as much to do with luck as skill. There was no way to predict how the mission would unfold. Bazak didn't allow his sub to linger long before he gave the orders that sent her creeping up to the 12-mile territorial limit claimed by the Soviets. Then, just inside. His orders allowed him to do that, to even go inside the 3-mile territorial limit recognized by the United States. This was the real beginning of the operation, the start of a planned 1-month routine. Move in by day, get close, keep most of the sub's 287-foot-long and 27-foot-wide bulk hidden underwater, while allowing the periscopes and antennas to broach the surface.
Each night, Gudgeon was to move out 20 or 30 miles, just far enough so that she could run her clamoring engines and charge her batteries and snorkel, bringing in fresh air and exhaling carbon monoxide and other noxious gases through a special pipe. The exercise would provide enough air and battery power to last through another day of silent submersion in Soviet waters. If the mission went as planned, Gudgeon would not run her engines anywhere near the Soviet coast, and she wouldn't surface past snorkel depth until she was well on her way back to Japan. Until then, the men would live in their cramped steel shell, working through a haze of diesel fumes that even snorkeling couldn't erase. Her crew hardly noticed the smell anymore. Their clothes, their skin, their hair, everything was drenched in eau de diesel, the trademark scent of a submariner, and one that masked other insults. With the crew's shower usually filled with food, the men had at best a half a basin of fresh water a day to wash in. Thanks to the new evaporators on Gudgeon, the water was far cleaner than the running, rusted tin available on older diesel boats, but it was in short supply, so the men devised tricks for making the most of the precious commodity. To wash, begin face first, then sponge down. The men ran salt water showers from the engine room bilges and mined a few extra cups of water from inside the boat by setting up buckets to collect the ever-present condensation that left everything on board damp to dripping. There was usually enough condensation to allow the men to wash their clothes at least once on each operation. That was bonus enough so that they hardly bothered to curse the mists that rose from the bilges, transforming their bunk spaces into metallic swamps. So what if their mattresses had to be kept zipped up tight against the dank with plastic flash covers? Every submariner learned fast to quickly unzip, slide into bed, and zip back up. Comfort was one thing. Staying alive was another. And for that, the rules were simple. Stay quiet, stay submerged, and above all, avoid being detected. That was the most crucial rule, and one Gudgeon was about to break. It happened on Monday, August 19th, 1957, sometime after 5 p.m. Soviet Pacific Coast time. Gudgeon had been submerged for about 12 hours. It would take 2 or 3 hours to travel to the isolated spot where she would snorkel, and then several more to take on enough air and create enough electricity to last through the next day. Already the air on board had become heavy. It smelled worse than the usual diesel foul, and it tasted just as bad. A bunch of men were in the mess watching the first reel of Bad Day at Black Rock. Over the whir of a 16-millimeter projector, Spencer Tracy, Lee Marvin, and Ernest Borgnine were playing out the days just after World War II. The movie was reasonably new. What submarines lacked in water, space, and privacy, the Navy tried to make up for with good movies and good food. Then, for a moment, the sub listed sideways. Only slightly, really, the sort of sway that normally happens beneath the surface in rough waters. But in the calm waters off Vladivostok, that sort of list only happened when the sail broached, causing a swell. Then Gudgeon began to dive. Again, it was nothing extreme, not an all-out plunge. This was gentler, just an angle that the crewmen could feel under their feet. Suddenly the alarm rang. There was nothing subtle about the call that came out over the squawk box. Battle stations! Now everyone was up and running at once, scrambling out of bunks, out of the mess, out of just about every corner, squeezing past one another through passageways not much wider than one man. They were grabbing onto the bars welded over the oval watertight doors, shooting their legs through to the next compartment, shoulders and head following. They came sliding down ladders and down stairs that weren't much more than ladders. All of them were making more noise than they could afford. "We broached,"
one man shouted to anyone who was there to hear.
The damn Russians are up there, and the old man just took her deep.
Some of the other men thought the electronic countermeasure's mast had been left up too long. It was about a foot wide and 18 inches tall, and the officer of the deck was supposed to bring it down the instant it tasted radar signals that meant the Soviets might be honing in on Gudgeon. Normally the mast was up only as long as the scope was, say 30 seconds at a time. But for these trips near the Soviet coast, the mast was kept up a bit longer, as other intelligence antennas had been added on as branches. Either the order to take it down came too late, or Gudgeon's depth controls were handled badly, perhaps leaving both the mast and part of her sail exposed. Either way, anything sticking out of these calm waters would have made Gudgeon all too easy to spot. And spotted she was. Soviet ships were heading her way, even as Bazak began shouting the orders for evasive action. Taking his boat down deep, he was looking for a temperature layer, a mass of cold water that could hide his sub by reflecting back to the surface any sonar pings aimed down from ships above. The Soviets would definitely be going active, sending out the deadly accurate sound beams that created the most complete picture of what was below water. They had no reason to try to listen through the static of passive sonar, no reason not to make noise. They weren't the ones being hunted. 100 feet. 200 feet. Bazak wasn't finding that layer he could hide under. 300 feet. Then the crew heard it. Ping, ping, ping. The Soviet probes rang steel chills through the Gudgeon and her crew. A ship had zeroed in on them. Bazak began taking the sub deeper and back outside the 12-mile limit. Many in the crew were convinced they had made their escape, but the Soviets were continuing to chase. Operating just on batteries and submerged, Gudgeon couldn't outrun them, couldn't do much better than a few knots. By now, just about every man on board was focused on getting away. Plainsmen held the sub steady through the dive. Other men kept an eye on the depth gauges. Bessick stood in the cramped control room issuing orders. Lieutenant John O. Coppedge, the southern smooth executive officer, beau to the crew, was by the captain's side. In stations set out in a circle around the captain were the fire control officers, who sat ready to aim and fire weapons if given the order, and the quartermasters, those navigators who stood over charts plotting course changes as Gudgeon moved to elude her tormentors. Out one watertight door, just outside the control room, the sonar techs sat in their darkened closet, watching screens and trying to count propeller sounds. There were two ships above, then more, all joining to pin down Gudgeon. Men began taking note of their status. Gudgeon's batteries were at that end-of-the-day low, her air that end-of-the-day foul. There was no way to run the diesel engines and bring in fresh air or recharge, not unless Bazak could drive Gudgeon near enough to the surface to raise her snorkel pipe and keep it there until the air was cleared. Carbon dioxide levels were already high enough that some of the men were feeling nauseous. Others had headaches, the kind where it felt as if the tops of their heads were coming off. This was the worst time of the day on any diesel sub, and the absolute worst time to get caught. Unessential equipment was shut down to conserve power and to squelch noise. The ice machines were off. The lights were dimmed down to emergency levels, more glow than illumination. Fans and blowers were off. Bessick gave the order to switch to relaxed battle stations, allowing many in the crew to take to their bunks to conserve oxygen. Above, a ship pinged Gudgeon, driving her toward another ship, which repeated the sonar assault. Every ping reminded the crew that someone on board had made a mistake. A big one. Word came from the sonar shack. There were at least four ships above now. The men cursed Charlie Brown, their name for the Soviets when they weren't using more
colorful descriptions. Then came another round of sonar pings. They were followed by something else, something far more terrifying. With a series of pops, a wave of small explosions rained down and around Gudgeon. She had been trying to change course again, trying to elude her captors, and they had answered. The Soviets were dropping light depth charges. They sounded like hand grenades into the water. The sounds came through the hull. Loud. The boat was okay. Gudgeon could withstand these small explosions. But what if the Soviets followed through with the real thing, with full-sized depth charges? Bazak began giving orders for a new set of evasive maneuvers. In the control room, the men worked, straining to listen beyond the sub. Others lay still in their bunks, listening as well, waiting for the thunder of bigger explosions, the kind that meant Gudgeon might never surface again. The younger seamen were noticeably nervous. The grizzled vets, the few who had been through World War II, could hide their fear better. But for them, this moment was actually far worse. They knew what a depth charge could do. They knew that their boat's namesake, the World War II sub named Gudgeon, was lost in the Pacific in 1944 and was believed destroyed by enemy depth charges. They had lost comrades on subs of that era, and some of them had been on boats that just barely escaped when those charges fell. They had felt the furious shocks, been drenched as seawater spurted through the wounded pipes of their fleet boats, wondered how long they could hold out inside fragile steel. The Soviets made another pass, then another, raining down pings and grenade-like charges.
"Stay calm. We'll get out of this," Bazak muttered to a young auxiliary man, still in his teens.
The youngster was already sporting talismans against catastrophe, tattoos of a chicken and a pig, one seared onto each foot. That was a tradition of sorts, taken from an old Hawaiian legend. Chickens and pigs, it was said, would always find something to float on and would never drown. Several of the men were marked the same way. By now, the siege had been going on for nearly 3 hours. Bazak continued to look for that temperature layer, taking the sub down to test depth, about 700 feet, and then a little farther. No luck. Maybe there was a layer at around 850 feet down. Gudgeon should have been able to withstand the sea pressure even at that extra 100 feet or so below test depth, and Bazak probably would have risked it. But there was another problem, one that prevented the captain from testing the extremes. Something had gotten caught in the outer door of the garbage ejector earlier that day. Everything that went into the ejector was supposed to be bagged and secured. Everybody on board knew that. Normally, a column of water is forced through the opening, and the water, the garbage, all of it is forced out to sea. But someone had just tossed something in there, probably thinking nothing of it, and whatever the object was had jammed. Now there was just the inner ejector door, one piece of steel, holding the ocean back. Even at a depth of just 200 feet, enough water could be forced by sea pressure through a 1-inch hole to overwhelm pumping systems and sink a sub. If the inner plate covering the trash ejector gave way now, with Gudgeon as deep as she was, she would be lost. One of the sub's senior enlisted men, a chief petty officer, had carried a bad feeling about that ejector all day, long before the Soviets came. He had suggested sending someone swimming outside the sub to clear it. But Bazak decided they couldn't risk that kind of maneuver. It wouldn't have been an issue if Gudgeon weren't now in a position where a little more depth might save her, but there could be no going deeper. Bazak began trying other evasive maneuvers. He called for the noisemakers, devices that could be shot out the signal gun in the stern room. They came in cans, each about a yard long. When launched, they responded by sending a wash of sonar-befuddling bubbles into the water, an effect sort of like a giant Alka-Seltzer. The Soviets weren't fooled. They answered Gudgeon's noisemakers with another round of grenade-like charges tossed into the water. Punishment for daring an evasive attempt? A taunt to show how badly it had failed? It didn't matter. Gudgeon was still under assault. Next, Bazak looked at his helmsman, and with a let's try it, began directing them to drive the sub right toward the enemy, hoping that was the one move the Soviets would never expect. It didn't work. Nor did it work when he sent his boat left, then right, then straight ahead again. Each evasive maneuver was answered with a storm of explosives. There could have been as many as 8 ships above now. One ship would pass over Gudgeon, then the next would come in for a run. Throughout, sonar men kept track of the Soviets, and fire control men kept her torpedoes aimed. But there was a general no-shoot policy for spy subs. Don't shoot unless shot at. So far, the small charges had not been replaced by heavier explosives. The siege continued. 12 hours. 24 hours. Nobody remembers Bazak, or, for that matter, Coppedge, leaving the control room. If they were getting any sleep at all, it was in quick catnaps. Most, if not all, of the crew were foregoing sleep as well, even the men confined to their bunks, who lay tensely, listening. It was chokingly painful just to move about, to breathe. The short trek from the chief's quarters to the control room left a man panting, eyes watering, as if he'd just run for miles. There was, of course, no cooking on board. Instead, the mess crew handed out cold sandwiches. Smoking was banned. It was nearly impossible to light a cigarette in the oxygen-depleted atmosphere anyway. Still, a few men found air pockets where they could light up and sneak a puff or two. The men bled oxygen into the sub from the large canisters affixed outside the hull, 2 aft and 2 forward. But adding oxygen could do nothing to reduce the carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide that were building to dangerous levels. Nearly everyone had a pounding headache. Some men were close to passing out. Canisters of lithium hydroxide crystals were placed around the sub to absorb some of the excess carbon dioxide. Some of the crystals were spread out on mattresses to help the process along. But the carbon dioxide levels remained way too high. The crystals could not absorb the carbon monoxide, the colorless, odorless gas that could eventually lull everyone on board into a permanent sleep. The Soviets kept Gudgeon cornered as they moved back and forth, sideways, diagonally, drawing spokes in a wheel defined by enemy boats. With each pass came pings, then grenades. Wednesday, August 21st, early morning. No change. Wednesday afternoon. No change. Wednesday, early evening. Gudgeon had been under siege for nearly 48 hours, and underwater without snorkeling for nearly 64 hours. Bazak had dutifully noted the distance traveled in his logs over these 2 days as zero. Something had to be done. Something drastic. Coppedge began walking through the boat, telling the men they were going to have to try to snorkel, try to stick our nose up. For most of the siege, the men had been at relaxed battle stations. Now they were called to full battle stations. They had to get fresh air. They had to send a message for help. They had to alter the status quo or die. "We're going to come up," Bazak announced in the control room. "As soon as we hit, start to snorkel." As Gudgeon came up, some of the men tried to run the hydraulics that would raise the radio antenna. The antenna wouldn't budge. It should have shot up with a bang, but all they could hear was one bump, then another. As soon as Gudgeon Snorkel broached the surface, the men started the engines. The sub took one gulp, then another. Then one of the ships made its move, came roaring right at Gudgeon as if to ram her, or at least to force her down. The Soviets weren't finished with the sub. They weren't going to let her men get air, and they certainly weren't going to let them yell for help. Someone hit the collision alarm, and Bazak gave the order to dive. The engines were shut down, and Gudgeon was back under. The crew hadn't been able to send an SOS. The air was just as bad as before. Bazak ordered Gudgeon down to about 400 feet, while he pondered his next move. He consulted with Coppedge, who talked to the engineering officer about the state of the batteries, and with Doc Huntley, the corpsman, about the status of the air and crew. Bazak had few choices. It was obvious that his men couldn't survive much longer. The batteries might last another 8 hours or so if the sub didn't move much, but that wasn't going to accomplish anything. The old man knew he didn't have the power to outrun his tormentors. Within moments, the decision was made. Gudgeon was going to try to snorkel again, and she would probably have to surface. But one thing would not happen. She would not be boarded. She would not be taken. The captain and the crew would die first. Not a single man on board objected. Bazak ordered all the torpedo doors opened. He knew the Soviets would be able to hear them, and he wanted to show that the Americans meant business. Then some of the officers were handed pistols, including Doc Huntley, who went around the boat waving his .45, saying it was his job to shoot the spooks if the Soviets tried to board.
"You could take a green pill or I could shoot you," he told one spook.
Doc had always been a little different. Doc probably wasn't authorized to go around touting his death's head mask. Maybe the crew mused he never should have been issued a gun, but he had the .45, and for the moment the spooks were more afraid of Doc than they were of the Soviets. Meanwhile, the spooks and the men in the radio shack across the control room, anyone who handled any codes or other sensitive papers, began loading them into leather bags that were speckled with holes and weighted down with lead. Some documents were destroyed outright. If the Soviets tried to board, those bags would go out the upper hatch and down to the bottom of the Sea of Japan. This was the moment that no submariner wants to experience, and it was one of the worst moments any captain could face. It was also a moment that was unavoidable. Maybe Gudgeon would have gotten away if she had been able to go deeper, if that garbage ejector door hadn't jammed. Whatever the reasons, Bazak had been beaten. Dejected, he gave the order to rise. Bazak wanted to get a message out to the U.S. base in Japan, but on the way up, the radio mast jammed again. As soon as the snorkel hit the surface, Bazak gave the order, and all three of Gudgeon's engines came online, shooting exhaust fumes into the sub's fouled atmosphere, as well as outside. Nobody cared about the exhaust now, not as long as the snorkel kept sucking in fresh air and venting out the worst of the poisons the men had been breathing. The sub was at periscope depth now, and it was clear that the Soviet ships were hanging back. But for how long? A minute passed, then two, then five. The men still hadn't been able to send the message, but Gudgeon was taking in air, shooting out exhaust. The men wondered whether their CO would go through with this and surface. Bazak was calculating, figuring his options, even at the last minute. Gudgeon would need at least 20 minutes of snorkel time to clear the air minimally, and that wouldn't even begin to charge her batteries. If she had to dive again, she could, at best, crawl through the water on battery power. If she stayed at snorkel depth, she could transfer one engine to charging the batteries and still move a little faster. But it was only on the surface that Gudgeon could make a run for Japan at her top speed of about 20 knots. There was no telling whether the Soviet ships would try to charge again,
But at that speed, and with a head start, maybe, just maybe, she could outrun them. He made the only decision he could. Bazak told his crew to surface. No one had been wounded, no swords had been broken, and no territory had been given up. But the United States had just lost a crucial battle. For the first time in this Cold War under the sea, a U.S. sub had been forced to give up, to come out from hiding, and sit, vulnerable, on top of the waves. After that, Bazak told his men to send out an all-too-late cry for help. "Send the damn thing in English," he shouted, answering a question from the radio man the crew called Badass. There was no use trying to hide who they were anymore. The message went out unencoded. Meanwhile, the captain began climbing the long ladder that led from the hatch in the control room to the sail and up to the bridge. After him climbed one of the officers, a signalman, and a crew member to man the voice-powered phones that would send Bazak's orders ringing through the ship if the Soviets moved in for a fight. If there was a destroyer out there, Gudgeon didn't stand a chance. It was still daylight outside, and the men on the bridge could see the Soviets. Two ships, maybe three, were left on the surface. All of them were smallish sub-hunters. The Soviets had pulled the rest of the ships back. It didn't take a crowd to herd a sub on dying batteries. The Soviets signaled, "Able, able," International Morse code for, "Who are you? Identify yourself." Gudgeon sent back, "Able, able." The Soviets answered, "CCCP," Russian for USSR. Gudgeon sent back, again in International Morse code, "USN, we are going to Japan." The response came back, a directive for Gudgeon to get underway and away from Soviet seas. The signalmen blithely interpreted for the crew. They said, "Thanks for the ASW exercise." Thanks for helping us practice anti-submarine warfare. He unsuccessfully suppressed a grin. The rest of the crew was grinning as well. In fact, the men were elated. They were getting the hell out of there. The celebration had already begun when it seemed like hours later, U.S. planes flew over to see whether Gudgeon was okay as she raced on the surface, putting as much distance as possible between herself and the Soviet Union. For the first time in days, the cooks heated up the ovens. There was steak for dinner that night, and